It is not to be wondered at that, being kept in prison unjustly as he regarded it, and seeing effort after effort for his release come to nothing, he was sometimes very downcast. Even at times, beset by oppressive fears, Kalenge and Cobb, he reflected, had spoken of his being transported to Spain, or Constantinople, or even something worse, that is to say, execution. Supposing this happened, would he face it like a man, or be fearful and trembling, and bring dishonor on his faith? Such thoughts beset him quite often, and then, too, there was the plight of his family. The parting with my wife and poor children hath often been to me in this place as the pulling the flesh from my bones. I often brought to mind the many hardships, miseries, and wants that my poor family was like to meet with, should I be taken from them, especially my poor blind child, who lay nearer my heart than all I had beside. Oh, the thoughts of the hardship I thought my blind one might go under would break my heart to pieces. In order to support Elizabeth and the children, he set diligently to work in prison to make long tagged thread laces for riding boots and other footwear, and sold many hundreds gross of them to shopkeepers and other dealers. Elizabeth was busily engaged in pillow lace making and in basket making, which brought in some money. And John's friend, John Holden, a Bedford brazier, also helped by using John's tools and equipment and taking on some of his regular work. This John Holden may well have been Elizabeth's brother or some other relative of hers. Then there were the gifts of the wealthier members of the Bedford meeting, and sometimes collections made on his behalf. It was a struggle, but their trust was in God, and he supplied their need. For the first months of John Bunyan's imprisonment, he seems to have been given special favors from the gaoler, who, on several occasions, allowed him liberty to go beyond the prison walls. John even managed to preach in various places, in woods, isolated farmhouses, and fields. I followed my wonted course of preaching, taking all occasions that were put into my hands to visit the people of God. He even got as far as London to see Christian friends there. In the earlier part of his imprisonment, he was also present at some of the meetings of the church and took part in its affairs. On 28th August 1661, a minute in the church book records, "Our brother Bunyan was instructed to visit and remonstrate with two backsliders, Brother Robert Nelson and Sister Manley." They were similar entries later on, and it is evident that Brother Bunyan was highly regarded for his pastoral care and warnings. The church was being harried and had to meet in secret from place to place, sometimes as far afield as Haynes or Gamlingay. The church book was locked away from 1664 to 1668 for safety's sake, and no minutes were recorded. But prayer was made unceasingly by the elders and members for one another, and the spiritual life of the church was maintained bright and strong. The new Restoration Parliament, which met on the 8th of May, 1661, was almost entirely Tory and Anglican, and it proceeded to impose an Anglican pattern on the nation by means of four great penal laws known as the Clarendon Code, instigated by Edward Hyde, Earl of Clarendon, Charles's chief minister of state. The first was the Corporation Act, December 1661, which limited membership of municipal bodies to those who received communion according to the rites of the Church of England. The second was the Act of Uniformity, which Kalenge drew up, which made the use of the Revised Prayer Book, 1662, and ordination by a bishop compulsory for all ministers of religion. It was passed by the Commons by only 186 voted to 180, but its effect was to eject 2,000 of the best clergy out of their livings and to sever the connection between the Church of England and other Protestant bodies on the continent. The king did not care for it because he had strong Catholic preferences and hoped to bring in toleration for Romanists by granting toleration for nonconformists. In May 1664, a new Conventicle Act was passed forbidding all religious meetings except those of the established church. The fourth of Clarendon's acts was the 5 Mile Act of October 1665, passed at Oxford, where Parliament was sitting owing to the plague in London. This act forbade nonconformist ministers to teach in schools or to live within 5 miles of a corporate town. This resulted in hundreds of faithful Puritan preachers and teachers being deprived of their work and banished to obscure places. This repressive legislation caused great dismay and trial to thousands of people. They had grown to love the simplicity of dissenting worship, extempore prayer, plain exposition of Scripture, and the right to choose their own pastors outside the ranks of those ordained by bishops. But they determined to suffer for their convictions and to make a stand for liberty of worship. Britain and the United States of America owe much to their faithfulness and fortitude. To a man of vigorous spirit like John Bunyan, used to an active outdoor occupation, it was a grievous thing to be confined to prison. But he had much to occupy him. Besides making the tag laces, he spent much time in reading and writing. At first he had only 2 books, the Bible and Fox's Book of Martyrs, a fitting companion for a man in his situation. His copy published in 1641 had his name in large capitals, John Bunyan, at the foot of the title page, and the date 1662. It is to be seen in the Bedford Library. As to his writing, in the first 6 years of his imprisonment, he wrote no fewer than 9 of the books which presented the Christian faith to thousands of poor Christians throughout the country. He reached more by his pen than ever he could have done by his voice. As the months passed by and persecution of nonconformists increased, the county gaol became crowded with ministers and laymen, even including a few women. They held daily meetings for prayer and Bible study. A visitor wrote, "I have heard Mr. Bunyan both preach and pray with that mighty spirit of faith and plero free of divine assistance that has made me stand and wonder." There was a well-known story of Bunyan in his early prison days, that on one occasion, when the gaoler gave him liberty to go out, he was seized with a spirit of misgiving and came back before he was expected. He had not returned long before one of the magistrates came to inquire if all the prisoners were in, and especially if John Bunyan was safe. The gaoler, immensely relieved at being able to produce John for inspection, told him he might go out when he liked, for he surely knew better than the gaoler when to return. News of John's ventures abroad, however, were soon known to the authorities, and the gaoler was threatened with dire punishment if they continued. Other gaolers came and went through Bunyan's 12 years in prison, some kind and others harsh, but there was no more preaching outside. In his book, The Life and Death of Mr. Badman, published in 1680, he says, "When I was in prison, there came a woman to me that was under a great deal of trouble. It turned out that she was in service to a shopkeeper at Wellingborough, whose till she had robbed again and again. Smitten with remorse, she came to ask Bunyan what she should do, being moved to do so by having read one or other of his books. He pointed her to the one who forgives repentant sinners and counseled her to make restitution to her master. Though in prison, he was the spiritual guide of some, who were outside. Some of the stalwarts of the Bedford Church soon joined him in prison, Samuel and John Fenn, and many more. John Donne, the ejected rector of Purton Hall in the north of the county, sentenced to banishment before 1668, was still in Bedford Gaol in 1672. William Wheeler, ejected from Cranfield, and John Wright, the pious saddler of Blenheim, were also there, and many more of John's Puritan friends. On one occasion, 60 of them, meeting in a wood, were surprised by the officers of the law, and the whole company marched off to prison. The whole gaol became a conventicle. The overcrowding must have been very uncomfortable, but though John Bunyan could not go out to a congregation was brought to him. The day room on the first floor, which John Howard, the prison reformer, tells us, was used as a chapel, surely witnessed stirring scenes. Some of the sermons John delivered there were afterwards turned into books, such as The Holy City, published in 1665. In this atmosphere and situation, John Bunyan made rapid strides to full maturity in spiritual things, culminating in his writing his autobiography, Grace Abounding to the Chief of Sinners, published in 1666. I have continued in this condition, that is, in prison, with much content through grace. He had indeed, and in his valuable book, Christian Behavior, 1663, he writes, "When Christians stand every one in their places and do the work of their relations, that is, work that relates to them, then they are like the flowers in the garden. They stand and grow where the gardener hath planted them, and then they shall both honor the garden in which they are planted and the gardener that hath so disposed of them. From the hyssop on the wall to the cedar in Lebanon, their fruit is their glory. There was calm amidst the stress and strain. There was no bitterness of spirit on account of his treatment, for in his heart grace reigned." There were lighter moments also. Years before, while still at Elstow, he had made a violin after an Italian pattern of thin iron plates on his brazier's anvil, inscribing on it his name, John Bunyan, Elstow, with a graving tool. Now in prison, he spent many secret hours in shaping a flute from the rail of his prison stool. He carefully hollowed the wood and used his candle flame to burn the small note holes in the barrel. When finished, the flute gave forth faint musical notes, and in the evenings, after the gaoler had made his rounds, he played on it with zest, hurriedly replacing it in the stool when the gaoler, surprised by the sound, returned to find its source. He never did. John little dreamed that centuries afterwards both violin and flute would be rediscovered and preserved as hallowed relics of his life. They are to be seen in the Bunyan Meeting, Bedford. The months of his imprisonment lengthened into years, and his children were growing up. Blind Mary, already in her teens, knew how to find her way to the county gaol with food or mugs of soup, and always with devoted love. Elizabeth was growing tall. John and Thomas were becoming sturdy little boys, and their father made alphabetical bricks for them. Wife Elizabeth came constantly to visit him, to tell him of the family and comfort his heart. Soon after the publication of Grace Abounding in 1666, he enjoyed a few brief weeks of release from prison. The unknown writer of the continuation of this book in 1692 says that after 6 years of confinement, by the intercession of some in trust and power, they took pity upon his suffering, he obtained his freedom. We have no idea who these friends were. It is possible that Sir Matthew Hale had a hand in it, or some influential London nonconformists. At all events, he went home to the house in St. Cuthbert's Parish, reunited with his wife and family. In 1665, the Great Plague swept London and far beyond, one of many periodic visitations which had terrified England since the Black Death. The awful cry, "Bring out your dead," sounded through London. The court moved to Oxford. Many nonconformist ministers, banished from London by the Five Mile Act, returned to the capital to minister to the sick and dying. In 1 week in September, the Lord Mayor of London recorded that 7,165 persons had died of the plague. The pestilence reached Bedford in 1666, and no fewer than 40 persons died of it north of the river. Things were far worse in Newport Pagnell, where 697 people were buried, including John's old friend, the bookseller, Matthias Cowley. That same year saw the death, though not by plague, of Christopher Hall, vicar of Elstow, whose sermon against Sunday sports had begun the process that led to John's conversion. Early in September 1666, the Great Fire of London occurred, which destroyed old St. Paul's and the heart of the city, including shops, warehouses, private dwellings, and 88 city churches. Samuel Pepys gathered up his money and plate and moved them into the country, as did many more. "The saddest sight of desolation I ever saw," he wrote in his diary. The fire affected John Bunyan, though he did not realize it at the time, because the sheets of the first printing of Grace Abounding were destroyed by it. A contemporary writer says that the late dreadful fire proved extremely prejudicial and destructive to most companies in the city, yet none of them received so grand losses and damage by the devouring conflagration as the company of stationers, most of whose habitations, storehouses, shops, together with all their stocks, books, bound and unbound by reason of their combustibleness and difficulty to remove them, were not only consumed in a moment, but their ashes and scorched leaves were scattered in sundry places above 16 miles from the city. The first edition of Grace Abounding is thus exceedingly rare, and the British Museum Library did not obtain its sole copy until 1883. The book itself, however, made John Bunyan's name widely known and brought inspiration and comfort to countless hundreds in those dark days. Free for a few weeks, John Bunyan resumed preaching and visiting his friends. Charles Doe, a later friend and hero worshiper of John, tells us that, a little after his release, they took him again at a meeting and put him in the same gaol where he lay 6 years more. Where this arrest was made, we do not know, but it was most probably in some field or wood thought to be safe from observation. A strong tradition exists that the subject he was to preach upon was, "Dost thou believe in the Son of God?" and that he had given out his text when the constable appeared, who turned pale and let go of Bunyan's arm, whereupon John exclaimed, "See how this man trembles at the word of God?" Trembling or not, the constable speedily conveyed him to Bedford Gaol, there to spend 6 more long years. Of this second period in prison we know very little. No doubt the routine was much the same, with constant prayer meetings and sermons for the prisoners. It is curious, however, that he produced only 2 books during this time, his Confession of Faith and a Defense of the Doctrine of Justification by Faith. This comparative silence is surprising, but the explanation may well be that his London publisher friend, Francis Smith, was out of favor with the authorities and could not get his books licensed. Or could it be that John's mind and pen were now busy upon his greatest work? Chapter 8, Pastor of the Flock. In April 1671, Charles II prorogued Parliament, which was not called together for 2 years, and unchecked by the Commons, did much as he liked. National affairs were in a bad way. Clarendon had been dismissed, and Charles passed from policy to policy as easily as from mistress to mistress. Always there was the need for more and more money, which Charles spent before it was raised. He was in debt to the city and to many private merchants. The Dutch war had been disastrous for England. De Ruyter sailed up the Medway and burnt unopposed the shipping in Chatham docks. John Evelyn beheld the enemy fleet lying unchallenged and at ease at the mouth of the Thames, as dreadful a spectacle as ever an Englishman saw. "People make nothing of talking treason in the streets openly," recorded Samuel Pepys, "and everybody nowadays reflects upon Oliver and commends him." But although Oliver had passed from the scene, there were many thousands throughout the land of the same staunch Puritan principles and steadfast faith. Charles entered into still closer relations with France, which made him practically the pensioner of the French king, Louis XIV. In 1670, he signed the secret Treaty of Dover, which pledged Charles to acknowledge himself a Roman Catholic and to bring Britain back under the popish sway. In return, he received from Louis a pension of £200,000 per annum, an immense sum in the values of the day, and the promise of troops if he was resisted by Protestants. This policy met with considerable opposition, but Charles controlled the first standing army England had ever had. The king was indolent and extravagant, and his court was a hotbed of immorality, gaming, and intrigue. Yet somehow he managed to be a popular monarch, and he could be a shrewd politician when it suited him. In order to carry out this French policy, he made the first move in issuing a declaration of indulgence in March 1672 with the aim of changing the government's official religious policy in order to benefit Roman Catholics as well as nonconformists. The king was jogged into this action, so to speak, by one of his humble subjects, whom almost all Bunyan's biographers have overlooked, and who was largely responsible for his release from prison and that of thousands of others. Not long before, at his morning levee, Charles had noticed a stranger whose face was vaguely familiar. He prided himself on never forgetting faces and searched his memory for a clue as to who this could be. And then he realized. Gone in a moment was the elegant palace of Whitehall in which he lounged, and his mind reverted to the terrible and dangerous days after the Battle of Worcester in hiding and seeking escape overseas. He saw again Shoreham Creek in the twilight, heard the sound of the waves on the shingle, the forlorn cry of the seabirds, felt the wind on his face. Felt once again the strong arms of a swarthy fisherman as he was carried out to a boat a little offshore. Yes, it all came back as in a remembered dream. He stared across the crowded room. It was the same man who had carried him to the boat and tended him in the tiny cabin, Richard Carver. He summoned the man to his side, wrung his hand, and thanked him once again for helping him to escape to France. He had been the mate of Tattersall's fishing boat that night long ago, and he had come, he said, for his reward. Charles's brow darkened just a little. Reward? Was everyone he met self-seeking? But Carver did not demand money. He had been converted, he told the king, and was now a Quaker. Since there were 8,000 Quakers in prison, would Charles not exercise his prerogative of mercy and release them? In eloquent words, he pleaded for their release, and Charles, much moved, gave a kindly answer. Since it suited his policy well, the Declaration of Indulgence was issued, and mercy extended not only to Quakers, but to all other nonconformists as well. He was too cunning to announce his adherence to Romanism, but indulgence to dissenters by all means. The King's declaration admitted that it was evident by the sad experience of 12 years that there is very little fruit of all these forcible courses, that is, the repressive legislation of the Clarendon Code. It continued, that there be no pretense for any of our subjects to continue their illegal meetings and conventicles. We do declare that we shall from time to time allow a sufficient number of places as they shall be desired in all parts of this our kingdom, for the use of such as do not conform to the Church of England, to meet and assemble in order to their public worship and devotion, which places shall be open and free to all persons. Nonconformist meeting houses were to be licensed by the Secretary of State upon application from the minister, and more than 3,000 licenses were applied for. Thus, after 12 years, Charles did something about those of tender conscience he had promised to help when he landed in England, and Richard Carver, the fisherman of Sussex, played a vital part in it. Let him not be forgotten. The prison doors opened, and thousands of England's finest citizens, including John Bunyan, stepped out into freedom again after their long ordeal. John, when first arrested, had been a broad-shouldered young man of robust health from perpetually tramping and riding in the open air. 12 years later, although only 43, there were many gray hairs in his auburn hair, many lines on his forehead, and a paleness on his cheeks. His memory, too, was scarred with the impact of what he had seen and felt, the stench of the rat-infested dungeon, the bitter cold of winter, the quarrels among the felons, the vicious practices of long-term criminals, the cruelty and corruption of some of the gaolers, the deaths among his fellow believers. Yet he had his happy memories also, the joy of Christian fellowship, the blessedness of the prayer meetings, the inspiration of the preaching, and above all, his visions of heaven and the road to it. There was also for John, was very human, the astonishing fact that he had become an author and had been enabled to use his pen for the service of God and the furtherance of the gospel. After 12 years in prison, and since the publication of Grace Abounding and his other works, Bunyan's status had markedly changed, and he was recognized as a wise and reliable leader of the nonconformists. The Bedford Church, after prolonged meetings and much prayer, solemnly appointed John to be their pastor on 21st January 1672. The church book recording this adds, and he, accepting thereof, gave up himself to serve Christ and his church in that charge, and received of the elders the right hand of fellowship. 7 of the most reliable members were appointed deacons to assist him in the pastorate, some of whom had been in prison with him, John Fenn, Oliver Scott, Luke Astwood, Thomas Cooper, Edward Dent, Edward Isaac, and Nehemiah Cox. In spite of all the repressive measures, nonconformity was everywhere on the increase. In Bedford itself, the 30 nonconformists of 1669 had grown to 121 in 1676, according to a religious census ordered by Archbishop Sheldon. In the whole county, there were about 1,000. The Quakers numbered 390, the Anabaptists 277, and the Independents 220. John Bunyan lost no time in applying for a license for a place of worship, not only for the Bedford meeting, but also for other small congregations associated with it in various villages, whom also he was to shepherd. In May 1672, he applied for his own license to preach, and also for 25 other teachers, and for 30 buildings, mostly houses and barns as meeting places. The Bedford Independents had acquired an orchard and barn which belonged to Josiah Roughhead. It was conveyed to John Bunyan of the town of Bedford, Brazier, and to five of his colleagues for £50, to be a place for the use of such as do not conform to the Church of England, who are of the persuasion commonly called Congregational. It stood in Mill Street, quite near John's own home in St. Cuthbert's Street. The barn was commodious, and when cleaned and fitted with forms and pulpit, made a fine meeting place. On the same site now stands the Bunyan meeting. His license, dated 9th May 1672, was for him to teach as a congregational person, not, be it noted, as a Baptist. It had to be shown to the civil authorities when he was away from home, as it was at Leicester in October, when he preached in a house close to St. Nicholas Church, and showed his precious license to Mr. Mayor, Mr. Overing, Mr. Freeman, and Mr. Brown, who duly chronicled his visit in the borough records. But his office as pastor of the Bedford Church and its associate congregations kept him mostly in his own county for a while. He was soon preaching in Bedford, Haynes, Ridgemont, Steventon, Pavenham, Kempston, and many other villages. Indeed, so active was he that he was called Bishop Bunyan by some, a term he would have much disliked. Many of the Congregational and Baptist churches over a wide area are said to have been formed through his preaching. He was now mature in his Christian experience, and his preaching was more balanced, although not less scriptural than formerly. Sometimes he went further afield to preach at Hitchin, Luton, Cambridge, Reading, and London. He had many nonconformist connections with London and usually preached there two or three times a year. Charles II heard that Dr. John Owen greatly admired Bunyan's preaching and asked in surprise how a learned man such as he could sit and listen to an illiterate tinker. Said Owen, "May it please your majesty, I would gladly give up all my learning for that tinker's power of preaching." Owen often heard Bunyan preach in London. In The Pilgrim's Progress, the interpreter takes Christian into his house and shows him a picture hanging on the wall. It was the picture of a very grave person. It had eyes lift up to heaven, the best of books in his hand. The law of truth was written upon his lips. The world was behind his back. It stood as if it pleaded with men, and a crown of gold did hang over his head. It is a portrait of the gospel preacher, such as John Bunyan was himself, and it is a challenging example to all Christian preachers of every age. Being pastor of the Bedford Church meant not only preaching, but visitation, personal exhortation, and pastoral discipline. The church book gives many instances of this latter duty. Edward Dent of Gamlingay was dismissed for mismanaging his sister's affairs. John noted in 1678 that he had to admonish Mary Foskett for scandal-mongering against Brother Honeylove. In February 1679, John Stanton was reproved for beating his wife. Other entries refer to members being lax in attendance at worship or walking disorderly in the ways of the world. John maintained with the utmost constancy the principles on which the church had been founded by John Gifford, with a wise tolerance on matters not fundamental to the faith. Nevertheless, new members were received only after careful examination of their spiritual state, and neither Arminians nor those guilty of dishonesty, gambling, or Sabbath breaking were accepted. The pastor had trouble with a man named John Wildman, who in 1680 at a church meeting made charges against the congregation with very great passion, and also accused John of scandalous financial misbehavior. The church listened gravely and then pronounced him an abominable liar and slanderer. He was eventually cast out. It is likely that his portrait is partly drawn in Mr. Badman. John Bunyan had a true pastoral heart. If any of those who were awakened by my ministry did fall back, he tells us, as sometimes too many did, I can truly say their loss hath been more to me than if one of my own children, begotten of my body, had been going to the grave. I have counted as if I had goodly buildings and lordships in those places where my children, that is, converts, were born. My heart hath been so wrapped up in the glory of this excellent work that I counted myself more blessed and honored by God by this than if he had made me the emperor of the Christian world or the lord of all the glory of the earth without it. And although he wrote this about his early preaching, it would surely be even more true of his fuller pastoral responsibility. He would be prayerful and faithful also in visiting the sick and the dying. John's family now consisted of Mary, Elizabeth, John, and Thomas by his first wife, Mary and Sarah and Joseph by his second wife, Elizabeth. It is interesting to note that Sarah and Joseph were baptized in St. Cuthbert's Church, and that Elizabeth, his wife, like Mary before her, was not a member of Bunyan's church. It would seem that she preferred Anglican worship. His father, Thomas Bunyan, now in his 70th year, still lived at Bedford, and surely not without pride in his son, in spite of all. John's own brother, Thomas, was received into fellowship with the Bedford Church in 1673. Bunyan's earliest Christian impressions and knowledge had come to him through the services in the Abbey Church, Elstow, where the prayer book of Edward VI was in use, at least in part, although he later resisted all efforts to make him accept and conform to the prayer book. He was still influenced by the order and reverence of the liturgical worship. The revised prayer book of 1662 he probably saw later, and it was undoubtedly enriched with new prayers and services. But for himself, he much preferred extemporary prayer, inspired by the Spirit at the time of its use. Some years before his death, he roundly condemned that loose and slovenly kind of public prayer that often degraded free worship in his day and also in our own. It is at this day wonderful common, he declared in The Pharisee and the Publican, for men to pray extempore. He is counted nobody now that cannot at any moment, at a minute's warning, make a prayer of half an hour long. He is not against extempore prayer, he says, for I believe it is the best kind of praying. But there are a great many such prayers made, especially in pulpits and public meetings, that are without the Holy Ghost, and therefore unedifying. Wit and reason and notion are now screwed up to a very great height. Nor do men want words and fancies or pride to make them do this thing. Of his preaching he tells us in Grace Abounding, in my preaching I have really been in pain, and have, as it were, travailed to bring forth children to God. Neither could I be satisfied unless some fruits did appear in my work. If I were fruitless, it mattered not who commended me, but if I were fruitful, I cared not who did condemn. It pleased me nothing to see some people drink in opinions, if they seemed ignorant of Jesus Christ and the worth of their own salvation, sound conviction of sin, especially for unbelief, and an heart set on fire to be saved by Christ with strong breathings after a truly sanctified soul. That it was that delighted me. These were the souls I counted blessed. He was not much impressed with those in the church that seemed to have great gifts, but were really like lifeless, clanging cymbals. A little love, a little grace, a little of the true fear of God is better than all these gifts. Let all men prize a little with the fear of the Lord. Gifts indeed are desirable, but yet great grace and small gifts are better than great gifts and no grace. Satan, so he asserted, designed to overthrow his ministry. Rumors were spread about him that he was a witch, a Jesuit, a highwayman even. Others claimed with the boldest confidence that I had my misses, my whores, my bastards, yea, two wives at once, and the like, to all which I shall only say, God knows that I am innocent. My foes have missed the mark in their shooting at me. I am not the man. I wish that they themselves be guiltless, if all the fornicators and adulterers were hanged by the neck till they be dead. John Bunyan, the object of their envy, would still be alive and well. More serious than these slanders, however, was the case of Agnes Beaumont in 1674. From 1670, the Bedford Church occasionally held its meetings at Gamlingay, 15 miles away on the Cambridgeshire border. The meetings were held in a barn, and here one day John met Agnes Beaumont from the village of Edworth. She was 20, and on her conversion had been received into the Bedford Church by Bunyan. She was a lively country lass and evidently much drawn to her pastor. She lived with her widowed father, John Beaumont, in a farmhouse at Edworth. Her brother and his wife, although not members of the church, were Puritans and often attended John's preaching. Originally, her father also had held nonconformist views, but a malicious neighbor poisoned his mind against both the Bedford meeting and Bunyan himself. In February 1674, Agnes, with difficulty, obtained her father's permission to go to Gamlingay for a meeting. But how should she get there, for mud and thawing snow made the 7-mile walk impossible? The only available horse was to be used by her brother, taking his wife on the pillion. So it was arranged that John Wilson, who was traveling from Hitchin, should call and take her pillion-wise. When the day came, Wilson did not appear. Instead, quite unexpectedly, John Bunyan rode up and called at her brother's home. They urged him to take Agnes to the meeting, and very reluctantly he agreed. So Agnes mounted the horse behind John, and off they started. Unfortunately, her father saw them from a field and was very angry. More than this, they were recognized as they rode into Gamlingay by a clergyman named Lane, a man who hated all nonconformists.
This Reformation audio track is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. SWRB makes thousands of classic Reformation resources available, free and for sale, in audio, video, and printed formats. Our many free resources, as well as our complete mail-order catalog, containing thousands of classic and contemporary Puritan and Reform books, tapes, and videos at great discounts, is on the web at www.swrb.com. We can also be reached by email at swrb@swrb.com, by phone at 780-450-3730, by fax at 780-468-1096, or by mail at 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, that's E-D-M-O-N-T-O-N, Alberta, abbreviated capital A, capital B, Canada, T6L3T5. You may also request a free printed catalog. And remember that John Calvin, in defending the Reformation's regulative principle of worship, or what is sometimes called the scriptural law of worship, commenting on the words of God, which I commanded them not, neither came into my heart, from his commentary on Jeremiah 7:31, writes, God here cuts off from men every occasion for making evasions, since he condemns by this one phrase, I have not commanded them, whatever the Jews devised. There is then no other argument needed to condemn superstitions than that they are not commanded by God. For when men allow themselves to worship God according to their own fancies, and attend not to his commands, they pervert true religion. And if this principle was adopted by the papists, all those fictitious modes of worship in which they absurdly exercise themselves would fall to the ground. It is indeed a horrible thing for the papists to seek to discharge their duties towards God by performing their own superstitions. There is an immense number of them, as it is well known, and as it manifestly appears. Were they to admit this principle, that we cannot rightly worship God except by obeying his word, they would be delivered from their deep abyss of error. The prophet's words, then, are very important, when he says that God had commanded no such thing, and that it never came to his mind, as though he had said that men assume too much wisdom when they devise what he never required, nay, what he never knew.